Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with John Darnton about his most unusual family.
At one point or other, my father, my mother, my brother, even my wife and myself, we've all worked for the New York Times. We're kind of like a West Virginia coal mining family that can't get away from the company store.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' Holland Cotter tells us about the life of Amedeo Modigliani.
Modigliani's work is more traditional. His subject matter is very straightforward. It's classical nudes, basically an academic style with some modernist moves.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. John Darnton, legendary journalist, particularly here at the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, foreign correspondent, very important editor here. He's also a best-selling and acclaimed novelist and now a memoirist. He has a new book called Almost a Family, a memoir. It's reviewed for us this week by Susan Cheever, who calls it a wonderful memoir, gripping, moving, and fascinating. I'm delighted that John Darnton is here to talk about his book. Welcome, John.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Why Almost a Family?
Well, it's basically a story of my father, who was, in fact, a war correspondent for the New York Times, who was killed off the coast of New Guinea in October 1942. At the time, I was only 11 months old. I have an older brother who's 2.5 years older than me.
And that's the celebrated historian,
yes.
Robert Darnton.
Yeah, exactly. Our mother, who was really grief-stricken, never remarried. And as a consequence, we grew up as a kind of tight little unit of three. And she raised us pretty much to follow the dream that she had had with her husband, that is, living and moving to the suburbs, kind of an ideal childhood. But it was really, it all fell apart. It didn't work, in part because I think there was perhaps too much pressure on her. So this is an attempt to come to grips with a childhood that in some ways seemed normal. But in other ways, was really just kind of fractured. And central to that whole idea was this myth of our father, whom we never knew, as a larger-than-life person who was smart and brave and debonair, laid down his life for his country and for the Fourth Estate. Newspapers were always very important in our family.
Well, your mother, too, was a journalist.
Yes. After his death, she went to work for the New York Times in the Washington Bureau as a reporter, and then came up to New York as the first woman's editor. So at one point or other, my father, my mother, my brother, even my wife and myself, we've all worked for the New York Times. We're kind of like a West Virginia coal mining family that can't get away from the company store or something. So the Times has kind of been interwoven in our lives from almost the very beginning.
Your father invented the Weekend Review, which I edited for a while.
He did. And also the first broadcasts over not QXR, but the predecessor to QXR. And he was apparently a rising figure in the paper. There were some, by the time I arrived in 1966, there were still some journalists who remembered him, like Murray Schumach, for one. And he said that there was a general thought that he might have been on his way to becoming the next managing editor. Of course, whether that's true or not, I don't think anyone could say.
John, let me quote you something you write in your book, because this is also a memoir about a search for your father. You grew up with one idea of him, and then you tried to find out who we really might have been. And you wrote, "While it may embody a noble aspiration, provide a source of courage and moral sustenance, that is, to grow up with a myth of your father, it is by nature founded on a kernel of fiction. And so living a myth is a dangerous business." And was it really dangerous? And how did that danger manifest itself?
I think it was. It's hard to describe what it's like to be a child without one of your two parents. A lot of people I know go through that. But basically, it's not as if there's a vacuum there. You fill that vacuum. And in this case, there was an absence, but it wasn't just a blank. It was a kind of presence of an absence. So I filled it, as did my brother, with this image of a kind of superhero father. This was perpetuated, I think, almost consciously by my mother. And as I mentioned earlier, she tried to kind of continue the life that they had dreamt of together. And she moved us to Westport, Connecticut, and began commuting in. After she worked at the Time, she founded a news service for women called Women's National News Service that began draining our bank account. And she began drinking heavily. And things went into a spiral for about 10 years, beginning, I would say, about 1948, for about 10 years. So that in Westport, we moved, we were kind of downwardly mobile. We moved into a succession of ever smaller houses, ending up literally by the railroad tracks in a rented apartment. She moved us to Washington, and her drinking continued to the point where she basically stopped functioning. My brother had won a scholarship to Andover, so he left. And I was faced with this situation as, I guess, finally a 14-year-old. And it culminated in one night when, a sleety night in Washington, when she had underwent a kind of series of convulsions, which were, I found out later, life-threatening, but upsetting to me. And I called immediately the doctor, who said, well, have you looked out the window? An ambulance can't get through. You'll have to handle this yourself. And she explained that I had to take a spoon and put it in my mother's mouth so she wouldn't bite her tongue. And I basically stayed up with her that night as she underwent these series of convulsions. And then, strangely enough, the next morning I just left, went off to school. And when I came home from school, she was gone. She had been taken to the hospital, and two very nice elderly women knocked on the door. I let them in, and our living room was by now a kind of shambles. We had chairs that had legs propped up in it, and so I remember saying, don't sit in that chair, it'll fall down. Don't sit in that chair either. They finally sat on the couch, which was working, and they said, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. Your mother is an alcoholic. And that was the first time the penny dropped and I understood everything that had been happening over the previous 10 years. It was really the pressures on her to continue this myth, the myth that basically our father's death wasn't going to change our lives at all, or even her life in any kind of a substantial way, and the myth that she could keep it all going herself by being both mother and father, by both nurturing us and providing us with a secure financial, you know, income.
When did it occur to you that you needed to know who your father really had been, what kind of man he was, and what did you find out?
Well, I guess that was a process. If I had to pinpoint it, I would pinpoint it to a trip my brother and I took to Scotland when we discovered on a very remote island named Sanda that there was a pub named after him. A kind of mysterious thing to have a pub named Byron Darnton at the other end of the world. But we figured out right away it was because there was a Liberty ship that had been named after him that ran aground on that very same island many, many years before and crashed, and the wreck was still partially visible. So we decided to go there to look at this ship, which we had launched as children back in 1943, not remembering any of that. So I began researching. My brother, who, as you mentioned, is an historian, wanted to write a book in the mid-80s about our father, but mostly about the lives of newspapers in the 30s and this kind of interesting wild period when there were so many papers around New York and a lot of journalists were part of a kind of quasi-bohemian circle around the village. And so he began conducting interviews. Thank God he did, because he talked to a number of people, all of whom are now dead and were dead by the time I got interested. Then, as these things happened, he wanted to write it with me. I was doing other things and for some reason wasn't interested. And he dropped the project. And then in the about 8 years ago, I got excited by the idea. And he turned over his notes to me. We discovered some things. We discovered, in fact, that our father was part of this kind of fast-living circle. Alcohol was extremely important to all of them. They had lived through Prohibition, so it still had, I guess, the lure of a kind of forbidden fruit. We discovered, we had been told this just before our mother's death in 1968, that our parents were, in fact, never married. Each one was married to someone else when they met. We had known that vaguely, but never put it together. So there was a kind of a tint of scandal to their relationship. Then I got hold of an FBI report on my mother and found that, in fact, the scandal was quite big at the magazine she then worked for and which she left. So she basically moved in with my father.
John, why was there an FBI report?
Well, she was up for a job with the federal government. She had worked for Office of War Information briefly during the war. And I think in the early 50s, she applied for another job that would have been sensitive, probably Voice of America or something along that line. And so Hoover ordered a background check. And it went on and on and on. She got very high marks for a lot of things. But it was discovered that they couldn't come up with the marriage certificate of their marriage. The FBI just seemed to go crazy over this. I mean, they had agents mobilized, in New Haven, Philadelphia, and each of their telegrams, which I was able to get, is signed Hoover. Now, I'm sure, I can't imagine it was J. Edgar himself taking such an interest. It was probably just a, protocol to sign it. But still, there are these incredible telegrams, check this wedding thing, Hoover. And she never did get the job. Then I was able to actually get their divorce papers in New York City, which Hoover was not able to get, I'm happy to say.
The divorce from the
from their previous mates. And putting the dates together, it is clear that by the time my father obtained his divorce, my mother was already pregnant with my brother. And I think that the idea of appearing in a Justice of the Peace house, with a full belly must have dissuaded her at least for a while. And then they never got around to it. And as she said, when she kind of confessed all this, when she was very ill, she said, well, we felt we already were married, so what did it matter? But it was interesting, the effect on us, because here was this perfect relationship, perfect in every way, and suddenly you find the piece of it, the kind of important piece, well, they were never married, doesn't hold up. I think my brother in particular was kind of bothered by that.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
That's John Darnton, whose new book, Almost a Family, a Memoir, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
Michelle Obama, what's happening there?
Well, she's joining the other writing Obamas, and she has a book deal, which was announced by her agent, none other than, of course, Bob Burnett in Washington. She's writing a book about the garden that she's planted on the south lawn of the White House, and she's going to write about the virtues of eating fresh and locally grown food and exercising, which, of course, has been the centerpiece of her work as First Lady.
She writing it herself, or will she have help, or don't we know?
We don't know. I mean, I assume that she'll do a great deal of the writing on her own.
Julie, you said they're writing Obamas. I think we all know that the president has been a very successful author. Are other members of the family writing books as well?
Well, his half-sister, Maya Satoru Ng, has a children's book coming out in April, and it's called Ladder to the Moon. And it's gotten pretty good reviews so far. Publishers Weekly has reviewed it, and they called it non-traditional spiritual literature for children, which doesn't usually work, but apparently in this case, it does. And President Obama, we know he's done several books, most recently a children's book, which was on the bestseller list, of course. And he has another book coming out. We don't know when, and we don't know how it will be defined, but he does have a deal to write one more book for Crown, which is part of Random House, and which is also publishing Mrs. Obama's book.
Is he expected to write this book while he's in office?
Not clear. He just signed a 3-book deal some time ago, and the second book of that deal was the children's book.
Do we have any idea how much he's being paid?
No, we don't. But we do know that Mrs. Obama did not accept an advance for this book, and she's going to donate her proceeds to charity.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Anyone even remotely familiar with or interested in modern art will know the great work of Amedeo Modigliani, the Italian portraitist and all-around genius. There's a new biography called Modigliani, A Life by Meryl Seacrest. It's reviewed for us this week by The Times' great Holland Cotter, Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome, Holland.
Thank you very much.
Well, here's the news for me. I didn't realize Modigliani died at the age of 35, leaving all this great work behind.
Yes, that's part of the story that's so important to his reputation.
So how did he get started? How did he become who he became?
He was born in Italy to an intellectual family, into genteel poverty, actually. They didn't have any money at that point, or very little.
And this is in the 1880s?
In the 1880s, yes, 1884 he was born. And became interested in art very early. He had a lot of illness as a child, spent a lot of time by himself as a child. And I think that's how he developed his interest in art. He was looking at books, a very introspective childhood.
And went to Paris, as the great artists did in those days.
Indeed.
Right, he's a contemporary, almost exact contemporary of Picasso and Braque, is that right?
That's
his
right.
Generation. What was he like in Paris? Another surprise for me was he's godlike in his handsomeness, for one thing.
Yeah,
you also say he approached sort of the role of the new artist, bohemian artist, a little differently from some others.
He did. He came to Paris with a little bit of money. He was being bankrolled by an uncle who, so he set himself up in a sort of princely fashion at first. That didn't last very long. He soon hit the streets, actually, and lived in various places. And knew all the people that you mentioned. He knew Picasso and Brancusi and Braque and became a sculptor originally and became a painter later.
What set his work apart?
In my view, it's a fairly traditional work compared to a lot of what was being done at the time. Picasso, of course, had been through his Cubist phase already, which is a very challenging phase, just right on the edge of abstraction. Modigliani's work is more traditional. His subject matter is very straightforward. It's classical nudes and self-portraits done in a very approachable style. I would say basically an academic style with some modernist moves.
Holland, explain to our listeners what you mean by academic in this context.
The subject matter, basically academic, of the studio nude. He has somebody sit down in front of him, paints that figure carefully. It's quite a different approach from Cubism.
And yet, he emerged as one of the handful of great lasting figures. So what was original about his work?
I think one of the appeals of his work is, first of all, that it is traditional, but with that extra bit to it that lets us feel that we're seeing something old and something new simultaneously. And I think people really find that very attractive. Also, I think his style is of a simple kind that lets people think that they too could do something approaching what he did in art. I don't think he's a remote figure. I think he's somebody people feel like, I could do that if I tried. And indeed, many, many people have copied Modigliani over the years. He's one of the most forged artists.
Oh, really?
On the books, yeah.
Just how skilled was he? What separated him from so many others who might also have painted in a more conservative or traditional, conventional style?
Well, you know, it's a little bit hard to say because a lot of those people have faded. We don't have anything to compare him with. But I think his use of paint was very particularly appealing. His way he painted skin tones in his nudes was just very attractive. And he was a hard worker. He spent a lot of time on that. And I think that's what kind of made him so magnetic to people.
Now, Holland, you say that Meryl Seacrest has written a strong, interesting biography here, and that one of her purposes is to revise the perception of Modigliani's of self-destructiveness. He did die very young, and alcoholism and drugs. What does she see as the real story of his life and death?
She sees that he did indeed use a lot of drugs. He did drink a lot. In her opinion, his persona as a kind of stumble bum, which he did get that reputation as the years went on, was in part a deliberate cover for the fact that he had tuberculosis. He didn't want people to know he had tuberculosis, a highly contagious disease. He had it originally when he was a child. It went into remission. It came back when he was an adult. And many of the symptoms that accompany the disease could be mistaken for symptoms that accompany alcoholism. Loss of memory, slurring of speech, exhaustion.
And is she convincing? Does she have much evidence to support this?
Not really. I think she would like it to be true. And I think the biography is remarkable in one way, and that is that it is very for its subject, and it wants to upgrade Modigliani morally in a time when a lot of biographers, I think, want to go in the opposite direction with their subjects.
Right, so she's not a debunker, not a pathographer.
No.
Is there something about Modigliani that is essentially attractive, and does it surprise you that she would view him so admiringly and want to restore his reputation in this way?
Well, it's a very personal book. I feel distant from Modigliani. I'm not a big fan. I never have been. She obviously is a big fan. She really loves him. She loves his work. She loves everything she knows about him. And she takes a very personal approach in the book, a very first-person approach. Mm-hmm. Takes it through every step of the research, who she met along the way. And you can tell it's a personal mission that she has. And I think it rests partly in the work and partly in her perception that his life has been misunderstood. And in some way, ethically, she just doesn't like that idea.
Thanks a lot, Holland.
Sure.
That's Holland Cotter, who reviews Modigliani, A Life, in this week's book review. All right. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Fiction has 5 new titles. Nonfiction has 6 new titles, including new titles at the tops of both lists.
So let's hear them. What are they? Let's start with fiction.
Fiction, there's a new Clive Cussler book, The Jungle. The real interesting book on the fiction list, the kind of unexpected bestseller this week, is a book called The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrett.
Not to be confused with Amy Chua. It's a different tiger.
Yeah, it's funny. At number 8 on the fiction list is The Paris Wife. And then, as you said, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother is Amy Chua's book. That's at number 11 on the nonfiction list. So The Tiger's Wife sounds like it might be a mashup of those two books.
The Tiger's Wife is getting a great deal of review attention, much of it extremely laudable. It was reviewed on our cover by Liesl Schillinger. Michiko Kakutani raved about it in the Daily Times. My predecessor, Charles McGrath, Chip McGrath, wrote a profile of her. What's so special about this book, Greg?
Well, keen readers may remember that Taya Obrett was the youngest of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 fiction writers, that list that they published last summer. At the time, she was just 24 years old. She had never published a book before. This novel is her debut book. Besides all the review attention that it's got, it just tells a great story. It's set in the Balkans. It's a war story. It's set during the war, the recent war there. And it also combines that story with a collection of contemporary folk tales that the protagonist, a young woman, heard from her grandfather as she was growing up. And now she's trying to sort through her grandfather's past and figure out what happened to him.
Now, what about the nonfiction list? What have we got there?
On the nonfiction list, David Brooks, our own op-ed columnist, leads the list this week. He enters the list at number 1 with his new nonfiction book, The Social Animal. That's an attempt to figure out human nature through sociology, psychology, some of the softer, the cognitive sciences. I almost called it a novel. That's because he, in fact, uses a couple of fictionalized characters as avatars to filter some of this social science through so that you can see how it plays out in these people's lives.
Greg, we have discussed how Taya Obrett has gotten these spectacularly favorable reviews and got it on the list. David Brooks, very prominent writer, a much admired columnist, hasn't really gotten the world's best reviews. What's he doing there at number 1?
Well, the book has gotten lukewarm to really negative reviews, both from the social sciences community and the hard sciences, too. In Salon, the biologist P.Z. Myers summed it up with the line, "Die, yuppie scum, die."
Ooh, that doesn't sound very scientific.
That's one of the nastier reviews out there. They haven't all been that bad. People weren't sure what to make of this fictional aspect of it. I think the book is selling because it really sums up a lot of the latest developments in social science in a way that tries to make sense of them cohesively. So it's kind of a Malcolm Gladwell approach, saying, here are all these different studies, different developments, and how the brain works. And he really makes an argument for intuition more than rational thinking as driving a lot of our decisions.
So, in fact, he says IQ is very much overrated as a component of human intelligence and emotional intelligence and all the rest.
That's right. You know, I mentioned Malcolm Gladwell, and there's kind of a blink component to this argument that your snap judgment is often going to determine what you do, and only later do you back up and justify that through your conscious, rational thinking.
Greg, you've mentioned there are a number of new titles on both lists. Anything else we should know about?
Well, at number 15 on the nonfiction list is this interesting book, The Company We Keep. It's by a pair of married CIA operatives who talk about how they met, what it's like working undercover in the CIA, and what it's like having a romance while you're also working as a spy. That book's gotten some good interview attention, some good profile attention. It's really an interesting story.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.